He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello.
So you ever look for a parking space in Boston and feel like pulling your hair out? In fact, let me put it another way. You ever look for a parking space in Boston and not felt like pulling your hair out? Well, Tom Menino may have a solution which could spread to other cities and towns. With us to describe Menino's idea is his transportation commissioner. That's Tom Timlin. Good afternoon, Commissioner Timlin.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie. How are you?
Great.
Fine,
Tom. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us. So there are probably people in their cars right now pulling their hair out. As Jim said, they're driving around Newbury Street. They're driving on Clarendon Street. They're driving on Broadway in South Boston, circling and circling. Give them the good news, Tom.
Well, as part of Mayor Menino's upcoming budget submission, which went to the City Council today, the Transportation Department has included $250,000 that will go to an in-street parking sensor. And what that does is these sensors would tie into an app on your cell phone that has a hands-free component to it that would let the driver know if they're entering a certain block, you know, I'm driving down Street X, how many parking spaces are available on that street. There's been national studies that have shown that 33% of congestion is directly attributed to somebody who is creeping along slowly looking for a parking space or, you know, worst case, double parked, waiting for somebody else to come out and move their vehicle. So what this can do is let somebody know that in the area that they're driving in, there's a certain number of spaces on a certain block available to them.
So how specific is it, Tom Tinlin? Would it say that if you're a block or so away, it comes up on the app and says in front of 362 Comm Ave, there's a spot, or does it just say between, what is that, between Hereford and Mass Ave is a spot? What does it say?
Exactly. It would go by block face. So it would say, hey, Newbury Street between Dartmouth and Exeter, there are five spaces. You know, the technology, which is being used now in San Francisco, New York just rolled it out, I believe even yesterday, the level of specificity, you don't want it to say, hey, in front of 123 X Street, there's a space, and maybe try to create some unpleasantness on the street. What
no
you're doing
kidding.
Is saying, don't slam on the brakes, because if you keep going, you're going to come to a parking space.
Well, can we talk about the unpleasantness for a second? My initial reaction to this, Commissioner Tinlin, is I love this. I mean, everybody has parking space frustration, but the flip side is, so there are 22 drivers who are within a couple of blocks, whatever the catchment area is for this app, of that location on Comm Ave. What comes up on their app is what you said. There are three spots between Hereford and Mass Ave on Commonwealth Avenue. The rush by dozens of people for those two or three spots is going to be intense, to say the least. Is it not? How do you deal with that?
Well, I think, you know, you have, I mean, I'm sure you've seen parking laws, right? I think you kind of have a, you know, no-hold-bars approach out there currently. You know, what technology like this does is just lets you know that on any certain block, there is spaces available. You know, from what we've gathered from other cities, we're not seeing kind of that hostile atmosphere and space banking and that kind of thing. But what we are seeing is that the consumer can make a better choice if they have the information. So, for example, if you're going down Newbury Street or another street in the city and you just want to pick up your dry cleaning, you know, you find a parking meter. If you can do your errand in 12 minutes or less, it costs you a quarter instead of maybe going into an off-street parking location and spending, you know, $10, $15, $20 or more. So it really what it's letting you know is that of the on-street available inventory for parking, these spaces are available. And it also it has layers to it as well. So if you are before you start your journey, you can see what's available in the area that you're going in, but it will also tell you when the meters are operable, what the times are, what
That's
the
great.
Payment method on those
meters
are. So it's really giving the consumer a whole plethora of information as it relates to parking
course,
that they currently don't enjoy.
But if you knew that the meter X was going to be done in 3 minutes, wouldn't you be stalking that space?
It won't tell you. I appreciate you asking that, Marjorie. So to be clear, it won't tell you how much time is left on a meter. What it will say is these meters go out of service at 6 p.m. Maybe it turns into valet or it turns into something else. It will tell you the hours of operation for the meter.
Our number is 877-301-8900. 8770. That's 877-301-8970. What do you think about these parking space apps? Is this a dream come true? Are you worried about being caught in a stampede on Commonwealth Avenue looking for the spot?
Hey, Tom Tinlin, let me give you a piece of advice, not the JS for it. You know what you should add to the information the apps do? They should take your blood pressure when you get to one of these spots and somebody gets – okay, forget that. Now, Tom, from what I understand from the Globe story today, $250,000 will fund sensors under 500 spots. Is that right?
Well, you know, it depends upon how many you want. You know, all of this is subject naturally to public bidding procedures
right.
and law. So, you know, we'll send it. We'll put an RFP request for proposal out in the street, and we'll see what we get back from that. But we believe that $250,000 will be at a minimum 500 spaces in the city, and then based upon the success of that, we'll determine where we want to push this program moving forward.
Great.
How many spaces are there in the city, Tom?
Oh, boy. On-street parking spaces
yeah.
in the city. We have over 9,000 meter spaces in the city, and that's in your traditional downtown area. I mean, on-street throughout the city, there's tens of thousands of spaces. But we only count the legal ones. I should point that out.
Our number 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, if you want to weigh in on this. So obviously, this is a very small portion of those 9,000 meter spaces. So are we talking about where are we going to have the 500? Where are they going to be?
Well, I mean, we're debating that internally now. We want to do it in an area that has the most demand. So we haven't designated, hey, it's going to be on this street just yet. You know, we want to wait to see how the discussions internally go. I mean, intuitively and with our parking enforcement officers, we know where the highest demand is. For example, where we write the most double parking tickets. But that will all be included in the request for proposal that the respondents will have to respond to if they want to do business in the city. You know, I should also point out one of the added benefits is, you know, there are so many people. If I'm going to Kenmore Square, I only know to park on Commonwealth Ave, for example, or
right.
Beacon Street or Boylston Street. But what this application also does, it might tell you off of the block that you're on that there might be parking opportunities off of that street that your meeting may be on mm-hmm. or the place that you want to go. There might be available spaces around the corner. And again, you know, we can't ticket our way out of congestion in the city, but what we can do is give the consumer more information in which they can then make an informed decision. Okay, I can park a half a block away and walk up because my app is telling me that there are five spaces that are available on the side street. You know, behind the Commonwealth Hotel, for example, in Kenmore Square. You know, it's one of those areas where you have an abundance of parking meters, but unless the Red Sox are in town, they're not always used.
Yep.
So we think this might help educate people where there is other parking available to them, on-street parking available to them as well.
Now, Tom Tillen, do you get a special deal as the parking czar in Boston? Do you have one of those blue plate specials, you know, those Boston official license plates that enables you not to have to worry about this kind of stuff, Tom? You can tell us here privately.
Let me tell you, between my blue plate and the big transportation department emblem on the side of my vehicle, that just says, hey, if this dope parks somewhere illegally, I'm going to take a quick picture and send it
to
Jim and Marjorie and let them embarrass him. So absolutely not.
Hey, right. Tom Tinlin, before we let you go, very quick, is the app free? Is the app free?
Well, you know, again, we'll see what we get back on the request for proposals
yeah.
in terms of what the app will be, but naturally the vendors will need to get paid. So, you know, that'll be all part of their request for proposal that it will be available to all vendors who can supply the city with this technology.
Transportation Commissioner for the City of Boston, Tom Tinlin, we really appreciate your time. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you so much, guys. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Great. 877-301-8970. I have to say, I love the idea. I mean, I don't know how anybody could not love the idea. Let's start with Sheila. You're in a car. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hey, Sheila.
Hi, guys. It's Sheila from Norton, and I'm actually looking for a parking spot in Boston.
Oh, where
are
you,
really?
Sheila? Maybe we can call the commissioner back and see if he can help you out. Where are you?
Well, I'm actually on Beacon Street, and I had two things. One is, I think in New York, they have something where an app also tells you the parking lots that are near and the prices. And I wonder if they could add that, so if you don't have the parking place, you can go to a parking lot. and that might be helpful too.
That's actually a great idea. And what they could also add is, what is the likelihood of that your car is going to be stolen at a particular? You know, Sheila, actually, that's a great idea. Sheila, good luck finding the spot. Thanks so much for the call.
Is there really anything? You don't want to go in a parking lot in Boston. I mean,
because the expense.
Oh my God,
it's colossal.
It's just a rip. You're there for 2 hours and it's $30. It's unbelievable.
Are you the kind of person who can deal with the blood pressure? I'm serious. Aspects of not being able to find a parking space.
No, I think
within a reasonable time frame, or are you not?
I think there are two kinds of people, Jim. We're on either opposite mm-hmm. sides of the fence here. There are people like you who will circle and circle and circle indefinitely. Correct?
As opposed to, you mean a double
giving
parking
up.
One spot?
No, giving up and going to a parking garage. I mean, I'll circle for a bit.
I will never go to a parking garage.
That's what I thought. You will
but there,
circle
I think
indefinitely.
Another thing.
You can miss the movie. You can miss the play. You can miss your dinner
exactly.
engagement.
Exactly. It's a matter
it
of principle. But there's another issue, Marjorie, before we get back to the calls.
What?
There are two approaches to finding a parking space. One, there is the circling approach, mm-hmm. which I embrace.
Yeah.
And there is the double parking approach, where you
I
just
do that.
Pick a good a street and you just wait till a spot opens up. I can't deal with the pressure of
but
that.
You know what the problem is, though?
What's that?
There becomes a right-of-way issue. Now, technically, if you are in front of the space, mm-hmm. you have the right-of-way because you can back into
Understood.
It.
Understood.
But how many times this has happened to me when I've been ready to back in and someone in one of those little cars snuck in and took my space?
Nothing worse than that, is there? 877-301-8970. We just spoke to the Transportation Commissioner for Boston, Tom Tinlin. Tom and Eno and his budget, according to today's Boston Globe, is including $250,000 for this app, which will, at least starting with 500 spaces, let you know if you're in the neighborhood that a space or several spaces is available for the taking. Let's go to
Chris from South Boston, where they park illegally with joy, Chris. How are you?
Triple parking. Hey, Chris.
Good, good. I just have a quick question about this app, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be on iPhones, if I'm correct, right?
Smartphones.
Yeah.
Including
well, iPhones and others,
so,
I'm sure.
Now,
yeah.
So that brings up the question of, it's almost like texting while you're driving.
Well, the story talks about a hands-free ability to do this without you know, having to text while drive.
Well, there may be a voice, like your GPS.
Yeah.
So I think they are addressing the whole question of
oh,
distracted driving.
I think it's a fantastic idea, then.
But,
fantastic.
Chris, let me ask you something, because I've done stories about this for the Herald, where you drive down Broadway in South Boston, and forget double parking. People are triple parking, like in front of the courthouse and in front of that coffee shop that's right there. And you know what's a weird thing, Chris? I very seldom see people with tickets. What's up with that, do you think, Chris?
I'm not really sure. I can honestly tell you, I never double park.
You don't?
You ever triple park?
Yeah.
Thank you, Chris.
I think it's
we appreciate
a favored,
your call.
I think it's a favored neighborhood. That's what I think. That if you are in those spaces on Neyland Street, for example, in downtown Boston, where it says no parking from 4 mm-hmm. to 6, the tow trucks line up at, 5 minutes of 4, and if you're not out of that space by 4:05, you are towed and you are gone. In South Boston, you can be double and triple parked in front of a particular coffee shop or a particular courthouse for, you know, 2 hours at a time,
days,
Jim,
maybe even
and
months.
And nothing happens. I'm very suspicious about that.
877-301-8970. Tom Tinlin said it's unclear what the cost will be. The assumption is the city will pay a piece of it, but the app user will pay a piece as well. Would you be willing to pay $5 a month, something like that, to have this app in your car? By the way, there's no argument against this, even though I said to Tom Tinlin, the whole issue of everybody rushing for one spot or two spots that they see on this app, that happens already. What possible argument other than the cost? What possible argument is against making finding a parking space in congested areas easier? I mean, this is exactly what they should be doing.
You know, Sam emailed a good question. By the way, our email is bpr@wgbh.org. If you have a question, he asked if the app actually indicates the space is empty or just that the meter has expired. And my understanding is that the sensor under these parking spots mm-hmm. indicates that the spot is empty.
Right, it says the spot, whether the
right.
spot's available. Right.
So it doesn't say that the meter's expired. That would be the next frontier, if you ask me. If you could be circling heavily parked areas and they would say, it's like the train's coming on the T, mm-hmm. 3 minutes till this meter expires, 5 minutes till this meter expires, then you could go down.
It doesn't mean anything to you, though, because it turns out the person may be running back like we all do to plop a few quarters in the thing with 1 minute left. Isn't that what you do? Wait till the last minute, set your smartphone with an alarm, and then you go back
well,
and
I don't
plop
know.
More
well,
quarters
well, some
into
people
the thing.
Do, and some people don't. Some people come and move their car. They know they've only got an hour and a half to park, and they come out and move their car. 877, oops, 877. It's not
617.
877 877-301-8970 is the number if you want to call and weigh in on the parking dilemma. 877-301-8970.
Why is this not happening? He mentioned it was in San Francisco, and I can't remember if he said or Sheila said there was something there. Why is this not happening everywhere? If the technology exists and the cost is not totally out of control, what you do is, he said it's 500 spaces or more, you pick the most congested parts of a town, mm-hmm. and you appropriate, in this case, $250,000, $500,000, to make parking easier, which is, I mean, it is one of the most frustrating experiences.
Well, you know what?
Somebody who either works or shops or lives in a neighborhood, it makes life easier and happier.
You know what's really frustrating are those new parking systems they put in where you have the machine halfway down the block. And you have to get out of your car. Say you're going to the dry cleaners. You have to get out of your car. You have to walk halfway down the block to put your money or your credit card in the machine. And very often you are waiting behind two or three people to do this. And then walk back in the pouring rain.
And you've got a ticket?
To put the money in the machine to run into the dry cleaners for 5 minutes.
It's one of the greatest systems that ever happened.
It is terrible. You know, it's so bad. You know, there have been so many complaints about them in Brookline. They took them out. Great
is that true?
And put
After
back
putting
the parking
them in,
meters,
what is
they're
the
awful. What are you talking about? They're awful. Do you want to walk down halfway down the block to put in? You go to the bank, you get a roll of quarters, you drive around town with your roll of quarters, or you put your credit card in. A lot of these meters, you don't want to walk.
No, but you know what it alleviates? Because one of the problems is you put a bunch of quarters in the meter and you leave early. You deal with the frustration of leaving a space and giving somebody else part of what you paid for. The beauty of those tickets is nobody piggybacks on you. I mean,
well, you know what the beauty of those tickets is? If you're not going to be an hour and a half in front of the dry cleaners, which you're not, you can drive around town and park in all these other places with your
That is actually, a lot of them actually have zones in them.
That's in
do
Cambridge.
You know that?
That's in
they
Cambridge.
They do, and they actually have actual parking spots. You have to type in the number of your space if it's in a municipal lot. In any case, that's the deal. Tom Tinlin was with us, and we appreciate it. And if you want more information, it's going to be in the mayor's budget, which is about to be released.
Okay, if the upcoming Whitey Bulger trial were televised, would anybody even care about the Whitey movie that Matt Damon and Ben Affleck are making? Well, we're going to talk about whether cameras should be able to film this federal case, and others. Famed lawyer Alan Dershowitz joins us to debate that issue up next on Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. You know, no one has argued more passionately in favor of cameras in courtrooms. And my guess is no one has argued more passionately against them than recently in a high-profile case in Nevada involving Dorchester-born, a major casino owner, Shelly Adelson. Joining us is the man behind both those arguments, one of America's top lawyers. He is Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz. Professor Dershowitz, great to talk to you.
Thank you, Evan. For having me on.
Thank you very much for being here. So, Professor Dershowitz, why was the case of Sheldon Adelson, who, as Jim points out, is a Dorchester-born and bred guy, gambling billionaire, why was the case an exception to your usual stance for cameras in the courtroom? You didn't want them in the case of his trial. How come?
Well, I'm generally in favor of televising all legal proceedings, Supreme Court arguments, Court of Appeals arguments, trials, but I'm in favor of doing them on a network like J-SPAN, like C-SPAN. I've always favored a non-commercial presentation, gavel to gavel, rather than simply selecting the most salacious minutes in order to, you know, sell their advertising. So my preference has always been for the establishment of J-SPAN based on C-SPAN, you know, kind of boring, non-commercial. You watch it if you want to watch it. Nobody's making any money. We're just like going to a courthouse. J-SPAN would be just like going to a courthouse. Of course, what the folks in Las Vegas had in mind was something very different, and that is commercial exploitation of the defendant, his wife, his family. Also, we were advised by the former head of the Secret Service, who is the full-time now security consultant to the Sands Hotel Corporation, that it would be dangerous. It would pose risks to the defendant in that case to be on television gavel to gavel, and we thought it was our responsibility to bring that to the attention of the court because the rules in Nevada specifically provide that the safety of the witnesses or victims or anybody else is to be considered, must be considered, in deciding whether to allow either televising of the entire trial or televising of a particular witness. So we presented those issues as required by the rules to the court.
And your concern, the national security or the safety issues, from what I've read, Alan Dershowitz, related to, one, his strong support of Israel, and two, obviously his strong financial support of people like Newt Gingrich and then ultimately Mitt Romney in the last campaign. Is that where that came from?
Much more the former than the latter. You know, in America, we don't threaten people and kill people whose politics we disagree with. We just, you know, respond to them. That's the nature of the First Amendment. That hasn't been true in terms of the Middle East conflict. And I can't discuss it on the radio because we had to present this material in camera. The judge ruled that it had to be done in secret. But I can tell you that the former deputy director of the Secret Service did testify about particular threats, particularized threats that had been directed at him because of his support for Israel. Yeah.
Have you ever, Alan, have you ever argued in any case, an individual case, not your broad position about cover to, you know, wall to wall as opposed to picking, as you call, the most salacious aspect of trials. Have you ever argued for an individual client before the camera should be barred from a courtroom before Adelson?
Neither side. I've never argued in front of a court on either side of that issue, to my knowledge. I've limited my advocacy to, you know, generalized speaking, but I've been one of the first people ever to call for televising of legal proceedings, and I've always called for it from the top down. That is, you know, when the United States Supreme Court heard arguments a few weeks ago on Proposition 8 in California and on DOMA, there's absolutely no conceivable reason why that should not have been televised live. There are no juries, there are no witnesses. The justices are obviously lifetime appointments, public figures. The lawyers are all prominent people, well known to the public. The issues are of great public interest. There's no salacious aspect of it. If it were put on a channel like J-SPAN, everybody would watch it. They'd be tuned to it. Nobody would make any money off it. That's the way it ought to be, the top first. I've always said that the last place you want to have cameras, although I support them, is in trials with witnesses, with jurors, with potential threats. So there are prioritizations of what should come first. And the Supreme Court has said, of course, no. Even Justice Souter once said, over my dead body, will cameras be allowed in the courtroom? He emphasized his own privacy over the rights of the public to know. And I think that's wrong. When it comes to trials, I think the decision has to be made on an individualized basis, and that's what the rules of Nevada call for. That's what most advocates argue, that it should be done on a case-by-case basis. I'm opposed to the rule that prohibits any televising in federal court. That, I think, is a mistake. It should be done on a case-by-case basis, and that's what I advocated. So I think my argument in this particular case was actually an argument in support of generally televising trials, saying, but if you have cases where there are special reasons for not doing it, that ought to trump the general presumption.
Well, Alan Dershowitz, I don't know if you read the Daily Beast, but a writer there praised your performance, as he called it, in the Adelson case, calling it, quote, a legal backbend worthy of a Cirque du Soleil gymnast. I thought that was pretty good, Alan Dershowitz.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, especially that was pretty good.
I was staying in a hotel right near the Cirque du Soleil, and I went to the Cirque du Soleil that night to watch the Beatles show.
Whoa.
So I'm flattered by being compared to the Cirque du Soleil.
It was very flattering.
I don't think it required any backbending. But as I said to the court, I opened my argument by saying, look, let's be frank, I always support televising of trials. I'm well known for my support of televising of trials, but I have supported them over the years in the following manner, the J-SPAN, the top-down first, and exceptions in cases where there is threat. So there was no backbending that required a lot of muscle flexing.
We should make clear the court ruled against you, correct?
The court ruled against us. And that, you know, that was no great surprise. There is a general presumption in favor of televising. The court did the right thing. It heard in camera the arguments about the threats, and then it made its rulings. And, of course, we have to live with that ruling, but we were given a fair opportunity to present the case.
We're talking with Alan Dershowitz about the issue of cameras in the courtroom. You've written a lot about this, and one of your arguments, Alan Dershowitz, has been that, I don't know if you were talking about the Supreme Court or the federal courts, but that the argument against cameras in the courtrooms has rested in some cases on elitist assumptions. What were you talking about when you said that?
Well, I think that there was an assumption that the public really can't understand what goes on in courthouses, that it would be above their head. And that's an elitist assumption that I think we should reject. You know, I was in favor of C-SPAN covering Congress. Has that worked? You know, Congress has figured out a way around that. They do most of their business out of the glare of cameras, but we get to see them when important events are involved, like the impeachment of former President Clinton. So, you know, we're moving in the right direction, but it has to be a nuanced move. We'll never accept, for example, televising of juvenile trials or
right.
television of trials, which involve perhaps rape victims whose faces. Remember the William Kennedy Smith
yes.
case where
yes.
they had to have a bubble
yeah.
over the face.
The blue bubble.
Yeah, so, you know, we've always made compromises with this right. Sometimes you even have to close the courtroom. I'm rarely in favor of that, and I've argued against that as well. But there are going to be cases where closing the courtroom is appropriate. I had a case once where we wanted to cross-examine. This is a fascinating case. We wanted to cross-examine a man who had been given a new identity and whose face had been changed. And so they made me cross-examine him with a bag over his head. And I said to the court, I can't do that. I have to see his expressions. I have to know the next question based upon whether or not I frightened him or I've, you know, gotten him to feel guilty. And finally, the court made him take the bag off his head and made me commit myself to not telling my client what he looked like. So, you know, we make all kinds of compromises like this.
That witness was not Greta Van Susteren, was it, Alan Dershowitz? Okay, Alan.
I actually did argue a case with Greta Van Susteren before she became a TV personality. We argued a case in Charleston, South Carolina, involving a Hare Krishna group. It was a fascinating case. She was a great lawyer before she became
yeah.
a TV
so I've heard. You know, Alan Dershowitz, when I hear you mention the threats that you can't enumerate vis-a-vis Shelley Adelson,
right.
I say to myself, well, the criminal defense lawyers listening to the show today, and they hear the legendary Alan Dershowitz talk about threats, and they say to themselves, well, my client in a criminal defense matter, he or she is either out on bail, and they're probably going to be threats because of the horrific nature of what they're accused of, or let's say they're a child molester who is the most apparently most hated criminal
right.
when they go inside a prison. Mm-hmm. Can't they make an argument just like yours? Hey, my guy is at great risk, and as a result, people at home shouldn't see the trial of this defendant. But
I think they should. I think it's a very strong argument. Particularly if you have somebody who's accused, let's assume somebody falsely accused of child molestation, and you have the cameras closing in on his face and indicating him to the public. Yeah, he's at risk. I think that is a strong case.
But every defense attorney always says, Alan Dershowitz, their client is falsely accused of child mm-hmm. molestation. So since you don't know whether he or she did it or didn't do it at that time, doesn't it create, I hate the term slippery slope, but I can't think of another one right now.
Sure.
Isn't it a slippery slope that suggests that this would allow for a huge spectrum of defense attorneys to say, I'm sorry, no camera should be in this courtroom for my guy or woman either?
I don't think it applies to cases involving, you know, white-collar crime. I don't think it applies to cases involving ordinary street crime. But when you have something like child molestation, where the victims are not shown on television, or even rape, which is the most horrible, horrible of adult crimes, where the victims are not shown on television, showing the alleged perpetrator who's presumed innocent against his will does raise serious questions. And yes, if somebody asked me to make that argument in a case like that, I think I would be compelled to make that
argument.
Well,
let me make the case that you could even make the argument in a case where you just said you wouldn't. In a white-collar crime, there's some big CEO or some COO who has essentially stripped the finances away from a company.
Take
there are a lot
Madoff.
Of
there take Madoff, right?
Well, exactly, and that's a better example than what I thought of. Wouldn't you make the case there? There are a lot of people really angry for all they lost, and I assume you know some of those people. They see his face on television, it enrages them even more, and increases the likelihood they're going to do violence to the guy.
You're absolutely right when you talk about the slippery slope. The slippery slope isn't an argument, it's a caution. And what we need is a matter of degree. We have to decide where to draw the line. All we did in the case in Las Vegas is ask the court whether or not this is an appropriate place to draw the line. The court in that case said no. In other cases, the court would obviously have said yes. In one respect, I'm glad they didn't find our case to be that compelling, because they would have if there had been massive threats every single day against him and his family. This court clearly would have not allowed television. Fortunately, the threats in our case were limited. I can't get into what they were. They were serious, very serious, but limited. And for that reason, the court ruled the way it did. I think in every case, you have to look at the evidence, you have to look at the facts, you have to look at the particulars, you have to balance the public's right to see on television versus the rights of individuals not to have themselves involuntarily thrust into the public just because they happen to be a witness in the case. Particularly in our case in Las Vegas, he wasn't even a defendant. He was a witness. And witnesses are called out of their privacy. Let's get another extreme case. Let's assume you had a Howard Hughes kind of character, who my client obviously was not, but a Howard Hughes character who never appeared in public, ever under any circumstances. There is always the danger that by subpoenaing him, you really can violate very considerable rights of privacy and extort him into settling a case which he would otherwise not settle. I know of at least one case where a very prominent defendant in California was being sued frivolously, and as soon as they allowed television in the courtroom, he decided he had to settle the case, even though he never would have been found liable, because the very threat of having his privacy violated by television would have hurt him very much. So it's a dynamic situation, and the courts have to consider every situation on its merits, and a balanced decision has to be made. There are no absolutes here.
Alan Dershowitz, you argue that the very first appeal televised in the United States, Klaus von Bülow, he was accused of murdering his wife, Sunny. And you've got, I've read a great story about, it illustrates the notion that people are going to start performing for the camera. You said something the exact opposite when you argued that appeal before the camera. What happened?
Well, what happened is I usually reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. I like to get the last word, obviously. In fact, I'm just finishing my autobiography, which will be out. Hopefully you'll have me on when
it's absolutely.
In October. And I have a very funny last word in that autobiography, but I usually like to get the last word. So I reserve 10 minutes. My associate counsel was now the very famous Susan Estridge. She was then just an assistant professor at Harvard.
For those who don't remember, Dukakis's campaign manager,
yes,
first
right.
woman ever
well
run a presidential campaign.
This was well before that. She was my associate. And I got up and I made my argument. And I reserved 10 minutes. I only spoke for 20 minutes. Then the other side did its half an hour. And I was about to get up and do my final words. The denouement was going to be on television. Wow. Susan grabbed me by my belt and said, "Sit down. You won the case. Don't say a word. And I'm not letting you get up." She literally held me by the back of my pants, and I just was able to mumble to the court, "If there are no further questions, Your Honor, the defense rests." And then, of course, the TV people were stuck. They had 10 empty minutes. They didn't know what to say. But, you know, my client's interest obviously came before any desire to be on television or to be, have the last word. And we did win the case.
But then in the movie Reversal of Fortune, the actor who played you, Ron Silver, gave this impassioned the closing argument. And what happened to Ron Silver?
Unfortunately, Ron died a couple of years ago.
No, I didn't mean that.
You mean what happened to the Dersh character?
Well, the people called him up.
What happened? Yes. After the case was over, he got a letter, a call from somebody on death row asking him to represent them. And Ron said, "Well, you mean obviously you want Alan Dershowitz?" "No, we want you to represent us on death row, not Dershowitz. You're a better lawyer." So
that's a great story.
Me a better lawyer. I tell you one thing, he's not a better basketball player. He has that scene in Reversal of Fortune where he's dribbling endlessly.
Yes.
I was a varsity basketball player in high school, mostly a bench sitter, but I'm very proud of my basketball skills, and I was really upset the way my basketball playing was portrayed on in the movie, but I was very happy with the way he portrayed me as a lawyer.
So when's the autobiography coming out, Alan Dershowitz?
Coming out, I think, October 16th. I'm speaking at the Boston, I think the first place I speak about it is the Boston Book Fair. And then, you know, I'll be speaking in other places.
So what is the last word? You just teased that.
I can't.
Oh, come on. Give us a little hand, Alan Dershowitz.
It is too good.
Hey, if you say so yourself, one last thing about the Van Bulow case. And I may be wrong about this, but I read the book. I actually didn't see the movie at the time.
The movie was great.
Aren't you urged in the – there's some hearing in the Van Bulow case that is being argued. And am I not right that the lawyer representing Van Bulow at that time – urges you not to be in the courtroom for fear?
Absolutely.
So, and if I remember correctly, don't you then sit at home or something like that and watch
the hotel room
and watch this thing on TV, right?
Absolutely. The Rhode Island lawyers were convinced that if a Boston lawyer set foot in the courtroom, he would be denied bail. And so I wrote the bail application, did all the work on it, and they made me sit in the hotel room watching the bail application on television to see whether he won or lost.
But would you have argued against the televising of that bail hearing if you had had the opportunity at that time, Alan Dershowitz?
I don't think so. It's not a jury trial. It's just a hearing. By the way, I didn't argue against televising of the argument about whether to televise. That was televised in Las Vegas, and I made no argument against that because that's a legal argument. I think all legal arguments should be televised. So we had no objection to that being televised. Obviously, they couldn't televise the in-camera hearing about the threats, but they televised every other aspect of the pretrial without any objection from us. All we objected to were the televising of the witnesses, the jurors, that kind of thing. By the way, the rules do prohibit the televising of jurors. You're not allowed to show jurors on television, even under Nevada law.
Alan Dershowitz, one last question for me. You were involved, of course, with the O.J. Simpson trial, probably one of the most sensational trials ever. You know, sex, race, sports, all these gorgeous people running around. And it was televised. But people were they saw snips and little pieces of it, and people were very upset about the verdict. Of course, he was acquitted, and many people thought he was guilty. But you made a compelling argument about how that might have been different had people seen the entire trial. Why?
I think that's right. I think they did some polls, and people who saw the entire trial from gavel to gavel were less surprised by the verdict. They may have been just as upset by the verdict, but they were less surprised at the verdict. And because when you see the whole thing, you get a sense of what was wrong with the prosecution's case.
Yes.
You know, we didn't win that case. The prosecution lost that case. And they just blew it. They made every mistake in the book. And if you were there every day, you could have predicted that as a possible outcome. But if you just watched the snippets on TV or read the media accounts, people were just shocked. They couldn't believe how 12 jurors could come to that conclusion. Some of them blamed it on race. Of course, the main juror was a woman named Denise Ashenbach, who was a white woman who had previously turned a jury around that was 11-1 for acquittal, and she was so powerful she made them vote 12-0 for conviction. We were very afraid of her. She voted for acquittal, but then a few days later she got on television and regretted her vote and said now that she knew what she knew she wishes she had voted for conviction. That was such an unusual case, and there were so many passions involved in that, and it was in California.
Now, let me just tell you,
California is different.
One last piece of history from New York. Barry Scheck was in my law school class, Alan Dershowitz. Had there been a vote for least likely to succeed, it would have been Barry Scheck. So obviously,
well, I have to tell you what happened. When I recommended Barry coming into the case, and it was my recommendation, there was a lot of opposition to that, saying he's too New York, he's too this,
he is really New York.
He wouldn't work well with a jury, and he was the star. He was incredible because he always kept his eye on the ball, on the forensic evidence, and he and I together argued that we shouldn't put on any witnesses except forensic, expert witnesses, only scientific witnesses. We had to maintain our credibility because we knew we had a very, very unpopular client. So the lawyers had to maintain their credibility. We didn't put on any witnesses who were false witnesses, whereas the prosecution put on police witnesses who swore that they didn't suspect O.J. the morning of the trial, and they climbed over the wall because they wanted to protect him, and, you know, this and that. The jury just didn't believe it.
Marcia Clark just called in and said to say hi, Alan.
I like Marcia.
I do, too. She's great on TV.
Alan Dershowitz, thanks so much for your time. We'll look forward to the autobiography in October.
Absolutely.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's always so great to talk to Alan Dershowitz. He's obviously a brilliant guy. Okay, for 20 years, Mayor Thomas Menino has run the city of Boston. Can your imagination even handle envisioning what Boston would look like if there were term limits? What would that mean for the city, for democracy? Term limits in Boston and across the country is next on Boston Public Radio.
Did you know that the first license to brew beer in America was given to a guy in Charlestown in 1637? It's true. And you can satisfy your thirst for knowledge at the Taste of WGBH History of Beer event, Thursday, April 18th at 6 p.m. at WGBH's studios in Brighton. And don't worry, your taste buds won't be neglected. You'll get to sample a bunch of history's finest brews while you're there. For tickets and more information, visit wgbh.org/events.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding everyone that adults play an important role in encouraging children to read. Reading is the key to success, so read to your children every day and encourage them to love books. And New England Eye Center, affiliated with Tufts Medical Center, vision correction options continue to expand from all laser LASIK to laser cataract surgery. Info about New England Eye Center and their refractive surgery team at mylasikdoc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And yesterday, former Boston City Councilor Tom Keene had an op-ed in the Globe. It was entitled, Term Limits Would Weaken Boston's Mayor. It makes a pretty compelling case, at least to me, that while it works for presidents, meaning term limits, it wouldn't have worked for Tom Menino or the people of Boston. I agree. I oppose term limits. Marjorie supports them. We want to know what you think at 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. 8970. And by the way, you could do a hybrid thing. You could say, if you believe this, they do work for presidents, obviously after FDR, limited to two terms. But for mayors, that's a whole different deal. I think, can I use the tiredest line in the history of American politics?
Go ahead.
We already have term limits. You know what they're called? I'm sorry, Marjorie.
Election
happens to be true.
Day.
They are elections, exactly.
It is the tiredest line of politics.
877-301-8970. The email address is BPR, as in Boston Public Radio, BPR@WGBH.org. Why are you against them? Why are you for them?
Let me ask you a couple of questions.
Sure, go ahead.
90% of the people in the United States of America think there should be background checks on guns. Why do you think we're not going to get background checks passed for this Congress?
Because of gerrymandering. Because the districts are drawn,
it is because
by state legislators ensures that no challenge will ever succeed.
Re-election. And if they were not worried about re-election and worried about their pensions and worried about their salary and worried about their health care, they might vote their conscience every once in a while. Why do you think we can't get money out of politics, Jim?
What do you mean money? Oh, you mean contributions out of politics?
Yeah.
No, that's a pretty powerful
argument.
Because
everybody's worried about their re-election. I would argue that one of the reasons we can't get anything done in the United States of America anymore is because being elected to Congress, being elected to the United States Senate has become a lifelong career. 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. I know you're going to tell me about Ted Kennedy in a
minute. That was my next argument.
I knew you were going to say that. But the point is, we are stuck in these terrible situations. Why do you think we can't get any immigration reform? Maybe we will this time. But why, if we get it this time, are we going to get it this time?
Because people are worried about their re-elections.
Exactly, Jim. Yeah. So if you weren't worried
about... So it's
about
working. So the electoral system is working,
no,
isn't it?
No, it is. Well... many would argue that it's taken us about 20 or 30
years. Who was sitting in that chair yesterday?
Ronald Reagan was talking about
it. Who was sitting in that chair yesterday?
I believe it was Deval Patrick.
It was Deval Patrick. And the conventional wisdom of at least a, I'd say, a significant majority of pundits, a word I can't stand, I don't know why I used it, is that the reason that Deval Patrick is being rebuffed, for lack of a better word so far, by the Speaker of the House and the Senate President, both of whom are Democrats, is why, Marjorie?
Because he's a lame duck. And you could make that same argument about Tom Menino now. He's a lame duck, so his power is slipping away from him every single day. But I would argue that the damage done by the constant money running of the country is ruining America. If we can't get reasonable, and the only reason we're going to get anywhere on immigration this time is because too many Republicans have figured out that they're not going to get reelected because the Hispanic vote is becoming more and more powerful. But like I said before, when was Ronald Reagan president? 1980? What is it now? 2013? Yeah. It's taken us an awful long time to get there.
He did a lot on, by the way. He did amnesty, which
I know is... but we haven't gotten anywhere on a pathway to citizenship for what? How many years is that? You're the math genius.
Pathway to citizenship
since
the
80s? Ronald Reagan,
30
yeah.
years, whatever
30
it is.
Years.
Okay, Marjorie, you've been in talk radio, what, 14 years, give or take a couple of months?
Yep.
How were you
as a talk... Well, we don't want term limits for talk radio.
I'm serious about it. No, but I don't mean this as a joke. How were you as a talk show host in year two compared to now? Were you as good as you are now?
It was rather an embarrassing start.
Okay, fine. It was embarrassing for me, too. Mm-hmm. And by the way, it was pretty embarrassing in year four. I would say as a former lobbyist myself, lobbied Congress, lobbied the state legislature. And by the way, there are many days when I emotionally said to myself, God, if there were only term limits, the world would be a better place. But I intellectually and I think in an honest way opposed them. The problem is being a governing person, whether you're a legislator, you're a member of Congress, you're an executive like a governor or president, it takes time to figure out how to do what you do well.
Then let's give everybody time. How much time do you think would be reasonable to learn how to do your job? Two
years? If you're Ted Kennedy, 40 years, I would say. Best senator in the history of the United States of America.
I would say the average worker can learn how to do their job probably in a few months, but we'll give you more time if you're an elected official to figure out, you know, all the machinations that go on up at Beacon Hill. We'll give you 2 years and we'll say we'll have a term limit of 12. How about that?
Now, would you, let's do, before we get to the calls, Menino for a second. You were one of many people, as was I, that waxed poetic about his 20 years.
I did. Poetic.
Let's assume that I think most people who think if you have a 4-year term who believe in term limits say 2 terms is enough. Do you think Boston would have been better without the last 12 years of Tom Menino?
Mayors, I'm less worried about.
Why?
Because I don't think. I think it's these big groups, Congress, the Senate, the House, the state legislature up on Beacon Hill. By the way, even you, a big liberal Democrat, think we need more Republicans up on Beacon Hill. Why do we never get any Republicans elected?
I don't know the answer to the question.
Because of the money and the power of the Democratic machine in Massachusetts.
So your theory is if there were term limits, the Democrats wouldn't win the same seats that Democrats are being reelected in, that term limits would fix the problem?
I think term limits would help the problem enormously in Massachusetts and every place else.
A77 301-8970 is our number. This is provoked by a piece by Tom Kane yesterday saying term limits would weaken Boston's mayor. Are you for him or are you against him?
Let's go to Michael in Falmouth. Hi, Michael. Home of the wind turbines everybody's fighting about. How are you, Michael?
I'm actually a town meeting member, and that's the reason why I called. I voted last night to keep them, and I know that that's any hope I have of, you know, possibly even keeping the town meeting job, but even doing anything else in town is going to be severely limited by the fact that they're so unpopular. But I felt so strongly about it that I knew that I had to vote to keep them. And if you look through, especially in Congress, at people like Tom Perriello in Virginia, who lost his seat after one term because he wouldn't vote against health care reform to save his job.
Yep.
If you look at Jack Brooks from Texas, who gave up his seat after, I think, more than 30 years in the House to vote for the assault weapons ban, Dan Glickman out of Kansas.
You've done your research.
You know, you see, there are politicians out there that will sacrifice, and I don't think we should limit good representation because of bad representation.
By the way, you said what I feel far better than
but
I did, Michael.
Michael, on the other side, you took a very courageous vote, and congratulations for doing that. And the other politicians you mentioned did too. But I would argue there's maybe a handful of you and hundreds of those who won't do what you
do. So elect better people. I mean, as Michael just said, don't make policy based upon the bad, but based upon the good. Michael, that was a great call.
Jim,
good luck with the turbine issue.
How long have people been trying to elect people, better people statewide in Massachusetts?
I don't think it's because terms aren't limited.
The power of incumbency is huge.
It is powerful. I would agree with that. Let's go to Mark in Shrewsbury. You're next with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about term limits in the wake of this piece about not term limiting Tom Menino. Hey, Mark.
Hey, guys. You know, the administration is an organization that is overseen by the Democratic representatives of the people. They are, our elected representatives are supposed to manage the police chief, the fire chief, all the way down to the secretaries at town halls and city hall. Mm. If we limit the bosses, the guys at the top, just because they've been there too long, they aren't going to have the authority, the strength to control the folks that they are supposed to be administering. After all, the police chief is not term limited. The secretaries at town halls and city halls aren't term limited.
Yeah, so but Mark,
limit their bosses?
But by the way, but there's a lot of insulation for, let's say, mid to lower level people in government who are sort of lifers. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way, who don't come and go when their bosses come and go. But you are right. When you move up a layer, people get to pick their own police commissioner, their own secretaries, their own commissioners, and that sort of thing. But how about, I'll make Marjorie's case, how about the power of money? That is a problem. Is it not in the power of incumbency?
Oh, certainly. The power of money and the power of incumbency are definitely a problem. But arbitrarily limiting them, whether it's a certain number of terms or a certain number of years, doesn't solve that, because then what you can do is have a situation where you just create a deep enough bench. When one mayor retires after being term limited, the next one, who's their hand-picked successor, comes up. Or in the worst, egregious case, you get like the Putin-Medvedev situation in Russia, where they just simply go back and forth.
Yeah.
Hey, Mark, thanks for the call. We appreciate
it. Poor Russians. Christopher is emailing. He wants to know if Jim is against term limits for his favorite politician. That would be, of course, the Senate president, Terry Murray from Plymouth, Jim.
Well, she happens not to be my favorite politician, but that's neither here nor, as they say, there.
One of the great stories of all time Marty Meehan. He is now the president of the University
Provo.
Of UMass.
Is he president or whatever he is, UMass Lowell?
He's a big deal at UMass Lowell. I'm not sure what his title is. I think he's the president. But anyway, his whole campaign when he ran for Congress was on term limits. He was gonna be in for two terms
two and
he was going to be out. Two and out. He had these slogans. It was his whole campaign.
Many people think that's why he won, by the way, because of his embrace of term limits.
Exactly. What happened to Marty Meehan?
He was there a while. He was there far. What
Suddenly,
was his explanation? I can't remember.
I think he went to the congressional gym and he said, this is pretty hot stuff. I got to stay here. Or maybe, I don't know. Maybe that was when he got rid of his glasses and embraced the contact lenses. I don't know.
You know, Marjorie, even if all your arguments are powerful, and some of them are pretty powerful, what do you say to yourself as a voter? Forget talking about somebody else in the abstract. There's somebody you really admire. It's on your town meeting member in Brookline. It's your governor. It's your whomever who really wants to run again. You think he or she is doing a fabulous job. And because of some arbitrary statute, you're denied, forget the elected official, you're denied the right to vote for who you want to vote for. Isn't that a problem?
No, I think that is a problem. But the bigger problem to me is that money is so corrupted the system now, and everyone's urge to get reelected is so corrupted the system now. Look at Mitch McConnell.
How about fixing the money? So how about fixing campaign finance laws rather than throwing non-bums out of office?
We're not going to fix campaign finance laws because how are people going to be able to fill their pockets so they can run for reelection again? It's all about politics has become all about getting reelected in the Senate and the House. Unless you're a millionaire, which a lot of the senators are, then they can raise a lot of their own money.
You know what the deal, by the way, one last thing about terms. You will hear many members of the House of Representatives who only serve for 2 years, which is ridiculous, say the day you're reelected, you start fundraising.
Well, they should have four-year terms.
Exactly.
Yes, they should. Jay in the car. What do you think, Jay?
I think we're hearing ideas of it's either going to be term limits or no term limits. And I believe there's some middle ground here. I think that one possible solution is to have a term limit that's only for a term. You go for your couple of terms, then you have to step down for one term. That sort of breaks the stranglehold, lets some new blood able to get back in, but then you're able to run again after you've taken that one term off. So if you've got that situation where it's a really, really excellent person, everyone loves them, we think they're the best man for the job, well, you haven't gotten them out of it for forever, but you still have at least had them take a break, let someone else get in. Let's see if there is someone else that maybe the public would like just as much. So I think there's some middle ground that might be a possible alternative.
What do you think, Marjorie, as a compromise?
I think middle ground would be great. Either that, what you're suggesting, Jay, or maybe saying, okay, depending on what the office is, you get 12 years or 14 years and then you're out. My problem is these people that are in there for their entire lives and they can't lose their job because they had no other job to go to unless they're going to be a lobbyist or something like that.
Thank you for the call, Jay.
Stephen has been persuaded by you, Jim, that all these politicians get better in time. He thinks we should transfer it to other areas.
Like what?
I can't wait, says Stephen, until the Red Sox starting lineup all have 30 or 40 years experience in the big leagues.
By the way, I term limited myself after one term, as you know, on the Cambridge City Council, which was for the public interest and also for my mental health.
I think serving is a little bit different than actually
then
running.
Exactly. Let's go to Arlene in Boston. We're talking about term limits, both in Boston, well, not just both, in Boston, statewide, nationally, all over the place. Hey, Arlene.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Marjorie, I love you and what you think, but on this one, I'm completely in disagreement.
Wait a second. Can we say who you are? I haven't talked to you in months. This is the can I say who you are or not?
Oh, absolutely.
This is Arlene Isaacson, who is one of the most famous lobbyists and one of the primary reasons that we have gay rights in this state. And Arlene, it's great to hear from you. Take it away.
Same here. Well, even when I've been on the losing side lobbying progressive issues, I must say that frequently the only reason we could get legislators to vote for a pro-gay issue when it was very unpopular or a pro-tax issue when it was very unpopular was precisely because they didn't have to worry about re-election. It was because they knew they had a safe seat so they could do something that might have been a little bit out of sync, which back 10 years ago would have been supporting same-sex marriage, or might be supporting progressive tax policy. So it's actually not as cut and dry as you guys were suggesting. It actually sometimes allows a legislator to do the right thing if they know they don't have to worry about the tyranny of the majority in their district.
I thought you were going to say something else, Arlene, that after all that time of schmoozing with these legislators and devoting your time to getting to know these guys and gals, how frustrating. You spend 10 years getting to know them, then they're gone. They have to start all over again with the next person. I mean, that's a good argument too, Arlene. But my argument in Massachusetts is that because so few legislators have to worry about their seats, it does breed a lot of corruption.
Well, you know something? I'd love to suggest that the people who have voted against the positions I advocate for are corrupt, but the fact of the matter is, more often than not, they really aren't. I like to think they're ill-informed or undereducated.
Okay.
But
ill-informed.
The fact of the matter is, most of them wake up in the morning and they essentially want to do – they represent – the legislature is a microcosm of – our entire world. 25% of them are hardworking, thoughtful, really detail-oriented, and brilliant. Mm-hmm. And then there may be another 20% at the opposite end of the spectrum, and the rest are the great in-between. They wake up every morning and they don't say, what evil thing or horrible thing can I do today to serve myself only? Most of them wake up thinking, I want to do something good, and the question is, I may disagree with what constitutes good for them. So for the most part, if you impose term limits, one of the problems that you create, and I can't believe as a lobbyist I'm about to say this, is you put a lot more hand power into our hands. Because if a legislator doesn't have a long-term knowledge of issues, because they've been around and they've seen this issue debated before, they become much more dependent on people like me. Of course, I'm trustworthy, but and people like...
By the way, that is a really important point that I wish I had thought
what?
Of, is when you are fairly new at your job, and I don't mean new like a month, but a couple of years, reliance on people who the public loves to hate, lobbyists, goes up exponentially. That's huge. That's a very good point,
absolutely.
Arlene.
Absolutely. And so, you know, if all lobbyists are wonderful, it's not an issue, but... I suspect the public probably wouldn't want to go
Arlene,
there.
Before you go away, I'm going to tell one last story that relates to this. That Arlene was and I were working together with a bunch of people to try to bring the graduated income tax to Massachusetts. It had lost on the ballot four times in a row. And there was a constitutional convention to put it on the ballot for the fifth time. And a guy who had voted for it all four times, he's from Lynn, a state senator, voted against it the fifth time. It was Walter Boverini. Do you remember him, Arlene?
Sure do.
And I went up to Walter after the vote and I said, Senator, after voting for this amendment four times over 20 years, why did you vote against this? Because we didn't lobby you, because we were disrespectful, because what? And he turned to me and I'll never forget these words. And he says, no, actually, Jim, now that I'm retiring, I can finally vote my conscience. So there you go. The late, great Walt. Hey, Arlene, it's great
Arlene,
to talk to you. Thanks so much for the call.
That was a great call. She has a rosier view of the legislature than I do. And I
no,
try
but
not
she
to
also
get
makes
the fact
a great
that
point.
Three speakers in a row have been indicted. I try not to hold that against the legislature.
Have you ever,
as well.
By the way, have you ever read?
I think we're unique in the whole country about.
Have you ever read the book Showdown at Gucci Gulch? Showed on Gucci Gulch. It's one of the greatest books ever. And Gucci Gulch, obviously, is talking about the shoes that lobbyists wear in the halls of Congress. Mm-hmm. And it talks about the obscene power that lobbyists have. And I think the most important point that Arlene made is, if you're inexperienced, who do you turn to for guidance on substance and procedure? The people you love to hate, lobbyists. I think it's a great point and a great argument against
it. I think a lot of them
it.
Are turning to lobbyists when they're very experienced as well, Jim. And that's causing us a lot of
That's
problems.
Also a good point, Marjorie. We'll get to that some future time. That's it for term limits at this particular time. It'll come up again in the future. Speaking of the future, what's coming up next, Marjorie?
What's coming up next is joining us, as he does every Wednesday at 1 o'clock, is Boston Globe editor Brian McGrory. We're going to be talking to him about all the issues of the week. Brian is going to be with us. Stay tuned, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Next month, the Boy Scouts of America vote on whether or not to end their controversial ban on gay participants. But one troop in Cambridge has been including not only gay scouts, but girls, too.
We learned how to tie knots, wilderness survival, first aid. Scouting is so nice and so fun, and it would just be really bad to exclude other people from it.
I'm reporter Ann Mostu. Inclusive Scouting, tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Xfinity Home from Comcast, the new home security and home control solution where you can watch your kids get home safely without actually being there or control your home from anywhere. You can learn more at Xfinity.com/home. And Blue Homes, building modern style green precision-built homes. On April 13th, Blue Homes is hosting a tour of three Origin units in Wayland, Massachusetts from 1 to 4 p.m. More at bluhomes.com/tour.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. He joins us every Wednesday on Open Mic. He's the author of Buddy, How a Rooster Made Me a Family Man, and he is the editor of the Boston Globe. That would be Brian McGrory. Good afternoon, Brian.
Good afternoon, Jim Browdy. Good afternoon, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm very well, Brian. Did you have a nice time yesterday at opening day?
I wish I could say yes, but actually opening day was 2 days ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not a baseball fan. Was it 2 days ago?
Wait a second. Let's
get
to the bottom
week?
Of this. You were there and you didn't have a good time, or you weren't there? What's the
This was the first one I skipped since 04,
oh.
I'm embarrassed to say. And it was like the most beautiful day of the the last century.
So it wasn't yesterday. I just want to be clear about that.
Let's get to the bottom of this. This is the WGBH Boston Public Radio investigative team, a spotlight team. Why were you not there, pretending that your new responsibilities as editor of the Globe were too demanding? Is that what the problem was?
I flourish best under the light of fluorescent lamps now. So, when you take me outside, I blink like a rat who's just come up from a deep hole. So,
just wait till next year, Brian.
Thank you.
So, Brian, we talked last week about the Globe's great series on the exploitation of taxi drivers and their being underinsured, et cetera, and the shenanigans involving nobody really looking into what was wrong. What's happening? Anything new on the reform front?
Well, we are, still continuing to press the city administration on what they plan to do, and Tom Menino seemed to roll out an ambitious set of ideas on how we plan to react to our series. So we'll stay on him to make sure he does follow up with that in terms of a citizen board and in terms of just far closer monitoring of Hackney and that whole range of issues. And then we're going to continue to press the state house, state legislators to find out if they're going to push this issue of cab owners being underinsured as these cabs roll around the streets. I mean, the idea that these cabs only have $20,000 worth of insurance on them if they hit somebody or cause an accident is pretty extraordinary.
Don't you worry, though? I mean, most but not all politicians have the attention span of gnats, Brian.
Well, look at Newtown as the example.
I was going to finish the sentence that way, down from 57% to 47% overall. When your series isn't blasted on the front page of the paper every day and when not everybody is talking about it, I mean, there's got to be some worry that great pronouncements, even though I didn't hear great pronouncements from Beacon Hill, at least great pronouncements from Menino. That was yesterday. This is today. I mean, let me finish the thought, actually. Now I think about it. Why is Mark Cohen, the guy who runs the Hackney Division at the Boston Police Department, why is he still employed? I mean, shouldn't that have been the first act? Goodbye, Mark.
Well, he's an interesting case. And, you know, granted, things got out of his control, it seemed like, pretty quickly. The problem with that whole decision right there is, yeah, she has done some good things in terms of modernizing the fleet and making the fleet green. But his grip on Hackney was not what you might expect. So, you know, those kinds of personnel decisions we'd leave to Menino. But trust me, we are not going to let this slide by. There was the issues are too outrageous. We spent too much time looking at them. The public reaction was too strong. We're not going to let it slip away.
You know, speaking of not letting it slip away, Deval Patrick is with us for an hour in the studio yesterday, making the case that essentially your editorial page has made that we need a ton of dough for transportation infrastructure work and for education reform. In all your years as a columnist and reporter, Brian, did you ever see Democrat on Democratic crime on Beacon Hill, like what's going on between the three Democratic leaders now?
Well, it gets interesting because in some ways, Jim, on Beacon Hill, Republicans and Democrats have historically gotten along better than Democrats and Democrats because with Democrats and Democrats, there's jealousy. There's you know, there's this kind of natural infighting that, you know, the they want control of it. I think we saw it with Sal DeMasi and Deval Patrick when Patrick was first elected. I think we're seeing it now. It's pretty unseemly. It's mind-boggling that these three people, Murray, DeLeo, and Patrick, can't get together and figure this thing out. And I mean, the idea that this whole moment, talk about slipping away, that this whole moment could slip away and we could end up with nothing is pretty frightening.
You know, when you say can't get together and figure this thing out, the thing that I am obsessed with, and maybe nobody else is, we spoke to the governor briefly last Friday, and then again, he was in the studio yesterday. Since last, I think it was Tuesday, when DeLeo, the Speaker of the House, and Terry Murray, the Senate President, made their $500 million pronouncement, allegedly with only an hour's advance notice to the governor, which was an hour more than he gave them on his initial tax package. One, he has had no meeting with these people. And we followed up yesterday having a discussion with him saying, what do you do at these Monday meetings when the three of you meet alone in a room? Do you not say, here's what I'm going to do? They say, here's what I'm... I mean, that to me is the most interesting part of this story. I mean, there is a personal aspect to this.
Can you imagine how stilted these Monday meetings must be? I mean, I can't even get my head around what must be said, but more important, what must not be said when these three get together. And the key question to ask, Jim, is why are they bothering to get together if they're not getting anything done?
Well, especially on something that's so central to the 2013 agenda for these three people. I don't get it at all.
Well, Jim may be obsessed with that. I'm obsessed with something else. So the governor, as Jim said, wasn't here for an hour yesterday arguing for why we need almost $2 billion in new taxes, transportation, education. And he almost had me convinced. But then I look at the story in the Herald today about all these people under 50 being able to retire in the state and get their pensions and their health care for life and stuff. And I think back to the waste and abuse in you know, $50 million between the EBT card screw-ups and not knowing about not monitoring food stamps, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, how do these legislators go back to their districts when these sorts of abuses are pointed out day after day after day and say, okay, your neighbors are retiring at 50, you're not, but you need to pay more taxes. You know what I'm saying, Brian? It's a tough one for these legislators.
I do know what you're saying. And, you know, Deval Patrick has the advantage of, you know, really not being around by the time these taxes are raised. He's going to be gone. And it's the legislators that are going to be worried about their own jobs. And for many of them, let's face it, it's the best job they'll ever have. And symbolism goes a long way in these things. I personally think Patrick would have gotten a lot more mileage if he had made some steeper cuts at the same time asking for this money because people, you know, for reasons that may well be justified, sometimes not, want to see cuts in government as they're being asked to pay more money for services that Patrick says they really need.
So what do you think about this piece that was in the paper by Larry Harmon earlier in the week in your op-ed page. We all, I did it, you did it. Everybody was giving these glowing hosannas to Mayor Menino when he announced he wasn't going to run again. And Larry Harmon, well,
let me read the opening
paragraph. Go ahead, read it.
Here's the opening. The headline is "No Salvation for Anyone on the Wrong Side of Menino." Here's the opening paragraph. "I am dead to Boston Mayor Thomas M. Menino, the angel of death, whose voice bore a strong resemblance to the mayor's press secretary. Dot Joyce descended on me 1 year ago to deliver the news, quote, the mayor will never speak to Larry Harmon again. When someone close to the mayor starts referring to you in the third person, you know they aren't kidding around." What was your reaction? I mean, I assume you weren't surprised by that, right?
No, I had heard it from both ends on that one. Look, at to know Tom Menino is to have been on his bad side at some point. I don't know if you guys ever have. I have certainly been on the receiving end of that over the last 20 years. I've been, iced out for protracted periods of time.
Oh, what'd you do? What'd you do to get iced out, Brian?
I mean, you know, look at you. I can't even remember at this point, but it's something that is so inconsequential that you wouldn't remember at this point, you know, and you just go with it. And, Larry Harmon is a really talented columnist. And if you're a good reporter, it shouldn't matter if you're iced out or not. You still have a job to do. You go about doing it. And, you know, if the mayor wants to talk to you, that's terrific. If he doesn't want to talk to you, well, you know, you still do your job to the best of your ability anyways. And, you know, look at there are a lot of reporters out there who always think it's easier to not get along well, to not have any relationships with the people they cover, because it makes it easier to write critically about them. You remember the George Frazier used to be a Globe columnist many, many years ago, a Globe Metro columnist, and he would bemoan the idea of actually going out and meeting the people he wrote about, because that means he couldn't write negatively about them once he met with them.
I have that problem. I don't like to get too friendly with people. It's been difficult because I like Deval Patrick. He's such a charming guy. Then you feel, when you see him up close and personal, for me anyway, it is harder.
I mean, Jim doesn't have that problem. He doesn't get friendly with anybody.
No, that's exactly
that. That would require things like eye contact,
exactly.
conversation.
But you know what's beautiful about that, Brian? It's a mutual feeling. It isn't something I do. You know, you said it a minute ago in this Larry Harmon quote, you heard it from both sides, meaning I assume you heard it from Harmon. And the other side of that means, did the mayor complain to you about Harmon?
I can't get into these.
You brought it up, not me.
I did bring it
this
up.
This is nervous laughter, by the way.
Nice,
for those.
That's a nice little, you set a trap, and there I am in it, and you're just kind of figuring out what to do with it. No, I mean, look, I heard about it. I thought it was a really interesting column that Larry did. I thought it was a fun column. It was a good column. And it just shows what, you know, the kind of the innards of how we cover politics sometimes.
But let me ask you, Brian, because I've kidded you before about holding court at the Capitol Grill and some of the finer restaurants in the city of Boston. I presume you were there with sources when you were having those meals. Haven't you found it as a reporter much more difficult to critique people that you have on a personal basis gotten to like?
I mean, I've mentioned this in print before, where I'll be taking off on some guy for making, you know, $20 million a year as a corporate CEO, and then my phone will ring and I'll pick it up and it's him. And I'll be like, you know, why is this happening to me? It is so much easier when I never talk to them, when they're just kind of a cutout figure in my head, the ultimate antagonist, and then you're on the phone with them and it's something entirely different. It's always easier when you don't know them.
I mean,
it's human nature.
By the way, that's why they invented caller ID, Brian. I don't know if you're aware of that. Hey, Brian, one last thing about this Larry Harmon from my side. When I read this piece, I spoke to so many people who said, Tom Menino, he's vicious, he's vengeful. Do you think there's a big city, long-serving big city mayor who doesn't do exactly the same thing that Tom Menino does if he's unhappy with you? I'm not defending it, but I don't think it's an aberration at all, is it?
I mean, I don't know. It's native to the mayoralty? I mean, would you consider, you know, governors, for instance? Do you consider Deval Patrick to be a vengeful governor?
I don't know what the answer is. What do you?
I do not. No, I think things roll off him a whole lot.
I think you're right.
A whole lot easier.
But wait a second. There's a difference. I'm thinking as you're speaking. The difference is, with all due respect, and I don't mean that much respect for the Boston City Council because they really have no power and they exercise none of it, virtually none of it. When you're a mayor of a big city, you are the autocrat. You run the thing. The governor, as we've learned in the last week, has to deal with 200 members who have a lot of power. So it's a different dynamic, don't you think?
Yeah, you're right on that. You're right on that. So, stick with the mayors. I mean, Daley, I suspect, was a lot like Tom Menino. I mean, Tom Menino used power in a way that we hadn't really seen here before. And I mean, power was a very intimate, or is a very intimate tool with Tom Menino. He uses it really, really well, really wisely. Usually to the good, occasionally not. He happens to be, I think, I would suspect by his own admission, somewhat thin-skinned about things. And, you know, when you're holding as much power as he does in the city of Boston and you're thin-skinned, there are going to be times when it always doesn't add up to the ideal scenario. That said, my experience with him is those have been relatively rare.
You know, if people don't know this, Brian McGrory wrote one of my favorite series of all time about Liberty Mutual and the excesses of the executives there and the heated tarmacs and their private jets and all that. I thought of you yesterday or the day before, Brian, when I read a piece about Blue Cross reinstating their salaries for the board of directors. One of the people on that board is from Liberty Mutual. And I didn't know, and probably I should have known, but where are you on this whole thing? Blue Cross took a lot of heat for paying the board of directors not a lot of money, but for the amount of work they had to do, $75,000. Then they went back down, I think it's between $40,000 and $50,000 now.
No, they went to zero, and then they reinstated
right.
it after 2 years.
Excuse me,
right.
You're right. They went to zero, then they kind of snuck back in with the $40,000 and $50,000 for the boards of directors. And they are a public charity. What do you think about these public charities paying their boards of directors?
So here's where I am, Marjorie, and it's a good question. I don't mind the these kinds of groups, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Harvard Pilgrim, Tufts, paying their boards, provided they actually have board members who are worth paying. And I think that's the key distinction. If you have good, qualified board members who know the healthcare system, know the insurance world, know how the two relate, then that's worthwhile. If you have a bunch of people you're bringing on the board just because you want to spread money out and create goodwill in the downtown community or in the labor unions or in the state legislature, Beacon Hill, then that's a complete crock, and it's a scam, and we should put an end to it. I suspect on this new board, I haven't looked at it real closely, I suspect there's probably a hybrid there.
Hey, it is a hybrid. I think it is a hybrid.
Brian, last thing from me. You are co-sponsoring with BZTV tonight a Republican debate in the Senate race with the three guys. A couple of nights ago, the Herald and UMass Lowell had the Republicans. Yet my the Democrats. While this is all anecdotal, my sense is there has never been a high-profile race with as little attention, despite the best efforts of the Globe, of the Herald, TV, and radio in this town. What's your are you frustrated as an editor? Because I assume you feel your responsibility is to play this as big as the office is. Do you feel a frustration that you and I think all of us are failing at promoting this campaign?
I mean, I do feel that frustration until I watch one of these debates and I wake up right at the end and realize I've been asleep for the prior hour. I mean, is that too honest an answer? I mean, it's a pretty somnolent affair that we're looking at right now, but we can't ignore the fact that it's actually important. Keep in mind a little bit of history, and that is back when Scott Brown was running against Martha Coakley in that first special election. Everybody was calling that a sleepy election until 3 weeks beforehand, and then it utterly exploded, and we had a phenomenal race on our hands. So I wouldn't be completely convinced of the fact the early going here is a dry affair, that that's how it's going to end.
But the primary, I guess Coakley did have a serious primary. Obviously, Scott Brown did not. The primary is 20 days away. It's less than 3 weeks away. And the turnout in this thing could be abysmal, but I guess I'm stating the obvious.
You also have to give the electorate a little bit of a pass here. We just went through a crushing political season here in terms of The Warren Brown race and Obama and his reelection at the same time. I mean, you're asking the voters, you're asking a lot of the voters at this point to just have what is turning into the perpetual campaign. And this is going to roll into the mayoral campaign, and the mayoral campaign is going to roll into the gubernatorial campaign. I mean, even in a hyper-political state like this, you know, voters are going to hit the wall on some of this stuff, and it's hard to blame them.
Brian, we were worried you wouldn't appear today after your disappointment on opening day, so we really
appreciate
it. Whether
it was yesterday, the day before, or the day before that. It was sometime this week.
We really appreciate Brian McGorry from the Boston Globe.
Guys, it's always a pleasure. I appreciate it very much.
Talk to you next Wednesday. Brian McGorry, as I said, the editor of the Boston Globe.
Brian McGorry is, as Jim just said, with us every Wednesday. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock is Christopher Lyon. Can't wait to talk to him. Up next, do you find it a little odd that as women female teams become a bigger part of sports, that the coaches stop being other women and they're almost always men? Jim is obsessed with that subject. We'll talk about it up next on Boston Public Radio.
Where to live, what to do, these are the challenges that face Cape Cod if it's going to attract and retain young people and families.
I think a community cannot strive and go forward without a good quality base of children. We're not a Sun City. We're not the Villages of Florida. We are Mashpee.
I'm reporter Sean Corcoran. Our series on the graying of Cape Cod concludes this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Welch & Forbes, celebrating 175 years of serving as wealth advisors to New England families. Welch & Forbes, knowing wealth, knowing you, on the web at welchforbes.com. And NOVA, from its birth to the emergence of the Earth we know today, explore the history of our planet as seen through the window of Australia. Australia's first 4 billion years premieres Wednesday at 9 on WGBH2.
This is Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Ginn. As you know, UConn won a record-tying 8th National College Basketball Championship last night, the women did, under the tutelage of legendary coach Gino Auriemma.
As we talked, we became a great team because everybody looked at everybody else in the eye and said, all right, this is what I'm going to give up. This is what I'm going to stop doing to help our team. And it was an amazing transformation.
Now, what struck me, and it always does in such settings, is watching powerful, skilled women athletes being coached by a man. It's not an aberration. In fact, it's become the norm. We want to know if the sight of an exuberant male coach giving his female athletes a victory squeeze gives you the creeps like it does me. Joining us to have this discussion is a woman who is an assistant baseball coach for Springfield College, the only woman coach in collegiate baseball. She went on to become the first woman to coach in men's professional baseball. She is now the director of sports partnerships for one of my favorite organizations, Sports and Society at Northeastern University. Welcome, Justine Siegel. Hi, Justine.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Well, thank you for joining us. So, Justine, you're the expert here, but from what I've read, that the that female coaches of female athletes are becoming almost an endangered species, and as salaries have gone up and the prestige of female athletes has gone up, more of the coaches have ended up to be men. So what's that about?
Yeah, well, I would say approximately 43% of all women's college athletic teams are coached by women. But the trend right now is to hire even more men. So, and since 2000, 68% of jobs have been given to men in collegiate sports. So the trend, as you can see, just watching, you know, the Final Four and Sweet 16, is there a lot of men on the court coaching women?
And, by
and the question is...
Why?
Go ahead.
Why?
Why? There's a few reasons why more men are attracted to the female sports now that there's more money involved. One of the trends that hurts sports and women trying to get advanced in sports in general is that a lot of athletic directors are men, and they're hiring men. You know, a lot of these jobs are who do you know and that type of thing. So women aren't getting the same chance to interview through the process and show what they can do.
And one of the reasons there's more money is, Marjorie and I read a piece in the Washington Post today, is while we're all celebrating Title IX, which is obviously great for female athletes, it's created more money in the industry. And with Title IX, there's more male interest. You know, one of the things that was also stunning to me, Justine, is this woman who wrote the piece said, of the five sports in which the United States fielded a women's team in the most recent Olympics, the only sport in which there was a female coach of the five was soccer. So is anybody working? Are you working? Is your sports and society working to try to reverse what I consider to be, at least at minimum, a troubling trend?
Yes, sport and society is trying to shed light on this trend. And we need to have more women get the opportunity to showcase their work. And if they're not given these avenues, if young women aren't seeing that becoming a coach is a viable job and a viable thing that can happen for them, then they're not going to pursue it. And that's a major problem. Unfortunately, women who have never been coached by other female coaches, actually, the research shows they prefer male coaches.
They do?
So this myth keeps going, but when they've had a female coach, then they don't have a preference for male or female. They enjoy having their female coaches.
Why do they prefer the male coach? Those who've had a male coach, why do they prefer a male coach? Don't tell me it's because they think the male coach knows better than a female coach would. Is that what it is?
It's not that they prefer a male coach. It's when they've had male coaches, it's when they've never had a female coach.
I see.
Yeah.
So if you've never had a female coach, you don't have anything to kind of gauge it on, and you go into the myth that only men can coach. If you have a man, they must know more than a woman.
You know, Justine Siegel from Northeastern Sport and Society, I want to ask this in a way that doesn't get me in trouble and doesn't put you on a spot.
Oh, here we go.
No, I'm serious. You and I have talked about this before, Marjorie. When you see male Olympic coaches in years gone by, for the United States team, for example, who are men, who are carrying around after an injury a little, I'm serious about this, a little 88-pound young woman who's a gymnast. Does that not give you the creeps, Justine?
Justine,
you can be honest.
Well, Jim thinks that they're child molesters.
No, I don't think.
Yes,
no, but it's a troubling visual for me. I have to say it is really troubling. But take it away, Justine. I'm sorry.
You know, I'm a female coaching in the men's world, you know, so I'm very used to this sort of mixed gender situation. And I don't think it's creepy. I can understand where you're coming from.
I think we
have to trust the men who are with us and that they're good men. Of course, there's plenty of great male coaches who only care about our girls.
By the way,
we need to remember that.
Before we let you go, Justine Siegel.
Yeah, I want to ask Justine about this, though, first, if you weren't going to. That you're talking about being in mixed gender situations. You were the first woman to throw batting practice to a Major League Baseball team, throwing the Cleveland Indians, and then you pitch batting practice, the Athletics, the Rays, the Cardinals, the Astros, and the Mets. I sound like a sexist myself, Justine. I'm surprised that you didn't get a horrible reaction to this.
Oh, no, Major League Baseball treated me really well.
That's great.
I've had other challenges coaching with men as they get used to you.
Yeah.
Once they realize you know what you're talking about and you can help them and you care about them, then the issues go away.
Where have you coached men? In at what level and in which sports?
I coached 3 years at Springfield College, and then I coached with the Brockton Rocks.
With
for
men?
A season. Yes.
And what's the, you said once they get to know you, once they get to know that you have the skills, they're fine. What are the issues? I assume they're the obvious ones, but what are the issues until they know that you actually know the sport?
I think the issue is just they assume that I don't know.
Mm.
And therefore I have to prove myself, whereas a man can walk on that field and automatically they're given the respect that they know. Whereas a woman's not given that same issue. And that's probably true in many sports.
Hey, Justine Siegel, Sport and Society, great organization in Northeastern. We really appreciate your time. Thanks, Justine.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Our number is 877-301-8970. You know, there are two layers of this. I don't want you to just focus on what I've said repeatedly, that I'm giving the creeps by some of these
things.
That's
right. You're projecting, Jim.
Justine made a very good point. I mean, if you are a young woman athlete, and the professional opportunities are obviously not nearly what they are for men, even though they're not huge for men either. Let's say you want to be a coach. And the only mentor or role model you see, as she mentioned, is a man, I mean, it closes the, psychologically or otherwise, the avenues of opportunity for you. And this whole notion that men weren't very interested in coaching college women until there was more money in it.
Absolutely.
Because Title IX is appalling, isn't it? I mean, it really drives me nuts.
Well, it reminds me of teaching. Teaching used to be all females. And then when you had men into teaching, suddenly the salaries went up and up and up and up and up. Not
so does this bother you or does this not bother you?
Well,
you're making fun of me.
Because I think you have this thing going on with the gymnast.
I don't have a thing going on. So does it bother you or it doesn't bother you? You're a woman.
It bothers me that women that are great athletes don't have the opportunities to become coaches that men do, because what happens, of course, is most men are not going to play in the NBA. They're not going to play in Major League Baseball. So what happens is they get hired to become coaches. They want to continue in the sport, and they're pushing aside some qualified women. So
do you remember Justine said the statistics since 2000,
yes,
in great part because of Title IX, since 2000, when theoretically we make progress in a positive direction, men have been hired for more than two-thirds of open jobs coaching women's teams in collegiate sports. It's ridiculous. And by the way, don't call and say, or you can, that Gino Auriemma is a great coach. Obviously, he's a great coach. He's won national championship after national championship. I'm not saying he doesn't know what he's doing, but I prefer to see a Pat Summitt, like the woman who won 8 championships at Tennessee coaching women, than I would see in men.
What I think is more incredible, though, is Justine just talked about, obviously she's a woman, coaching men's teams. I mean, I find
But she's
that,
the only one. There's nobody doing this. By the way,
she was
not only the first. There's virtually nobody.
I'm surprised she could do it. I mean, it's just the reverse sexism is huge. A number is 877-301-8970. If you'd like to share with Jim's problem about these coaches.
It's not a problem.
With the gymnasts. No, but the Olympics.
You know, you're somebody who's always talking about glass ceilings and all those kind of things. There is a huge
glass ceiling,
and all you want to talk about my obsession with these male gymnast coaches.
For a long time.
Well, I'm not even saying half of what I really think.
You are obsessed with the male gymnast situation.
Let's start with Sean in Dedham. Hey, Sean, you are next on Boston Public Radio. This makes me a little nervous. Hi, Sean.
Maji, how are you today, guys?
Excellent.
How
great to hear from you. Go ahead.
Jimmy, you're still, I got to watch my words. You're still worrying about Bella Caroli crowning this 50-year-old girl. You've been talking about this for years.
I have. And Bella Caroli is who I'm talking about, actually. I'm not making any accusations, but that's exactly the image. There was some little gymnast.
I think that was the 68
in the
Olympics gym.
Who weighed, you know, like 77 pounds
Corbett?
Or something. No, and she injured her ankle or something. And it's just the whole scene of him carrying her off.
He's just upset because no one can carry him across anything. So, you know, he's such a big boy. Listen, you're also very sexist, Jimmy. You know, if a guy wants to coach girls, or those guys, let them be. You're so caught up on this, and why don't you legislate? Why don't you go to the state house if you can pass a law? I'm surprised you haven't already got one foot out the door doing that.
Actually, I'm going to do it right now, Sean. Thanks for the idea, Sean. We really appreciate your call. 877-301-8970. It's just there's something wrong with this. And even if I didn't have the issue I have with some coaches, if they're the most responsible, as Justine said, most of them are terrific, treat the women wonderfully. I would argue the presumption that maybe is rebuttable is if you have a women's team, you should try to find a women's coach.
You know what's amazing, too, talking about the salaries of this great coach at the University of Tennessee, Pat Summitt, when she began her career in 1974, she was getting $250
That's a great story.
Not a week, a month. A month. And then before she retired at the end of the last season, she drew a salary of more than $2 million, which is great because these coaches are being paid, you know, huge, huge salaries.
And for those who don't know her, by the way, she yet last night when Auriemma's team, the UConn Women Huskies, won the national championship, they tied the record of Tennessee and Pat Summitt for 8 national championships. Let's go to Greg in Norwood. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Greg.
Hi there. Jim, the most entertaining thing were the coaches. Women's basketball is absolutely unwatchable. So I don't know if you've taken a look at the ratings, but I think, you know, America has spoken. The NBA is almost, like, out of business with their women's league.
The WNBA is not. Yeah, you're right. You're actually
right. And if you buy the men's NCAA tournament, you got to take the ladies with them. But the numbers are horrific.
They are, actually.
It's true. The same thing with the press conferences.
By the way, that one, I know this doesn't prove the other side.
What's her name?
Brittany, somebody who played for Baylor,
Greiner,
who didn't make it into the finals. I think they're beaten by Louisville. You ever see her play, Greg? And I agree, she's aberrational. She's great.
She's 6'8".
How about?
I just wanted know, she would kick my butt, and I respect her. But it's a terrible, terrible product. And the focus that this country has on sports is absurd.
Men and women's sports. You don't just mean women's sports. You mean sports in general.
No, but the fact that this Hippocratic NCAA passes this rule and all of a sudden people want to get involved, hey, listen, everybody wants to become a computer scientist until they find out how hard it is. You know, so, I mean, of course more people went after the jobs, but it got more money.
By the way, it wasn't the NCAA, even though you can blame them for most things. It was actually Congress. But, Greg, thank you for the call. Judith, you're in Dorchester. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Judith.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
I just wanted to give you some history. I was a coach at the Jeremiah Burke High School before Title IX, basketball coach, and I earned $175 a year as a staple.
Oh, Judith, that's terrible.
We were called play teachers, and the girls didn't have uniforms, and we had an 8-game schedule. We had no tournaments. We had no kids going on to college scholarships, and the opportunities were very limited. And then, under the leadership of Virginia White, who was in the on the softball team that was in the League of Our Own.
Mm. Yes. Oh, yes.
She was the assistant athletic director because they wouldn't allow a woman to be the athletic director. Mm. And so she had to be the assistant, even though she did all the work. She told the school committee on our behalf, there were no males coaching women at that time, zero, that if they didn't equalize everything, we would sue, which we would have. And so in 1 year, we went from play teachers to coaches. And then we earned $1,750 a year, which was what the men earned, which was a 10 times differential.
Judith, that's great. That's great.
Our titles were changed. Our teams were given uniforms, but it was still a very long struggle to get tournaments, to get Boston girls into tournaments, to get travel money and so on. But the upshot was that the men began to be hired, not so much because they were qualified as because the headmasters were all men and they hired their friends. So we had an influx of men coaching women, and most of the women were forced out. And that has continued to some extent, even now. And if you look at the women's program in the city of Boston Public Schools, it is horrible. We have no kids. Every year after year, there are two or three all scholastics out of all of the sports. We have half the sports that are in the suburban school system, schools. We have the worst program for girls you can imagine, even now, even though this has happened. So it's a very long process.
Yeah.
It has not been moving forward. It really has not. Now, you know, it's quite embarrassing to see how few scholarship opportunities there are for these talented girls, how few teams there are, how few kids are playing, but the coaches, we still get our salaries. So, you know, it's a sorry situation for girls, and it limits their opportunities, and it's not fair.
Judith, you said it so powerfully.
Thank you for a great call. It's absolutely right, and especially limits, as Judith said, their opportunities to get these great scholarships to college, which the male athletes can get. Judith, thank you very much. Okay,
Before we switch, a friend of mine, and you know her too, Mary Mazzio, who's a filmmaker with 50 Eggs Productions, made a film called, Bringing Up Daisy, or Hero for Daisy, which is about the whole Title IX fight, focused particularly at Yale University. Get it. It is a perfect depiction of the struggle women went through to get equal treatment in sports, and they're still struggling, as is obvious.
Mary Mazzio is a great filmmaker, and she's also an Olympian. She was Olympian in the she rode.
Barcelona Olympics, that is correct.
What is new on stage and silver screen? Joyce Kilhawick and WGBH's Jared Bowen are with us to bring us that conversation next on Boston Public Radio.
Yeah, there's some talk.
politics, family, finance, faith. Too often the conversations are limited to who we know. But in our fast-paced world, it's important to know the new faces at the table and the new ideas that could shape our lives. Whether it's immigration, politics, or parenting, we offer real conversation about real issues. Join us as we explore what's beyond the headlines on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you and Gardner Mattress, specializing in handmade, lace-tufted, and custom-made mattresses. Handcrafted wood bed frames on display also, celebrating 80 years, located in Salem, Woburn, and Newton. GardnerMattress.com. And Elsa Dorfman, Cambridge portrait photographer, still clicking with the jumbo format Polaroid 20x24 analog camera and original Polaroid film. Online at ElsaDorfman.com. That's ElsaDorfman.com.
Hey, you're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. And if you're wondering, what's the show, what's the movie you should be seeing, and what should you be avoiding, people to tell you the answer to that are Joyce Culhawick, art and film critic. You can read her reviews at joyceschoices.com. She is also president of the Boston Theater Critics Association. The other person in the room, in the studio, is Jared Bowen. He's GBH's arts reporter and host of the new weekly arts show, Open Studio on WGBH. Welcome yet again to you two.
Hi. Thank you both for coming. Okay, before we talk about my favorite thing, Great Gatsby, let's play a little clip from the 1974 version with Mia Farrow and Robert Redford.
Why didn't you wait for me?
Because rich girls don't marry poor boys, Jay Gatsby. Haven't you heard? Rich girls don't marry poor boys.
Can I just say one thing? I could have played both parts better than Mia Farrow and awful. Robert Redford played. Can we agree on that?
It was awful enough for that. Absolutely.
It was awful. But now we're going to play you a bit from the new Great Gatsby with Leonardo DiCaprio in the title role. Here it is.
Gatsby. He had a grand vision for his life since he was a boy.
I'm gonna fix things just the way they were before.
Just you and me. No amount of fire could challenge the fairy tale he had stored up in his heart.
Reminds me of the Titanic. Wonderful yeah performance there.
Let's hope it doesn't sink like the Titanic.
Well, so what do you think, Joyce Culhawick? Is this going to be a good version? Should we rush to the theaters?
You know, I would rush to the theater because it's Gatsby. It's a new interpretation of this classic work. We've seen it in the cinema. We've read it. I actually saw a whole staged reading of this once. I'm sure you did too, Jared.
Yeah, they read the American Repertory Theater. Yep. Fantastic
book,
production.
Whole book. And it held you spellbound. I would agree that the 70s version was sort of dead on arrival.
Unbelievable.
But the surface of it was gorgeous. It doesn't get more beautiful than Robert Redford, than Mia Farrow in those costumes. Baz Luhrmann is also about the surface of things because, you know...
In five little second snippets. I mean, That's how you get Baz Luhrmann, Moulin Rouge, of course, and Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Right.
I love that.
The problem is if you see this trailer for this movie, I mean, I am so excited about The Great Gatsby. Who doesn't love the story? And again, the production at the ART was fantastic. But I am so afraid now because this trailer is so awful.
It is?
I feel like they've cut every single scene in the movie into a minute and a half clip, and it's just terrible.
Agree. I saw it the other day, and I thought, oh, no, this looks dreadful. The camera's swirling around it. Actually, Leo looks, the performance looks a little stagey, but. It's a trailer. We cannot prejudge. It gives you some idea of the tone of the thing and the look of the thing.
When's this thing opening?
Who plays?
Early May, right?
10th.
May 10th. May 10th.
Who plays Daisy Buchanan, please?
Carrie Mulligan. Not the most exciting actress in the world.
I am madly in love with her.
She's a good actress, but I find her boring.
You've got to be kidding me.
No, just like Naomi Watts. Forgive me.
Like Frances McDormand is one. Meryl Streep is another. She's, for many people, she is. But there are two people who I will go see them in anything because I find they are fantastic in anything that I see.
Yeah, but she's not beautiful. I think Daisy has
not?
To. Carrie Mulligan? Are you
even know
kidding?
Who she is.
So who do you think we should have? The Attorney General from California playing the part or what? That's a whole lot. Sorry, that's a whole lot.
You have to have a beautiful Daisy Buchanan. It was like when they had Keira Knightley playing Pride
even
and Prejudice.
Mia Farrow, had a certain kind of fragile beauty about her. But no, Carrie's got the little bowl haircut, those little stumpy little features. But, She's, you know, I mean,
so
forgive me.
Choice,
it's
Cole
not
Hayward.
Low rent. When you're casting a movie, you play physically who you are. I mean, you're not going to cast Whoopi Goldberg in this part,
no, you're
right?
Not.
Okay, you might cast who? Amy Adams? You might cast some young, beautiful, talented blonde.
Yeah.
I mean,
Scarlett,
you know,
Johansson. But I think that she's beautiful. Did you see her in the Michael Fassbender movie, Shame?
I did.
Shameless,
and she sang the hell out of that song, The Girl Can Deliver. But she was not.
And that movie,
beauty.
An Education, she was a sprite young British girl
yeah.
falling
she was
in love with
ingenue.
The older man.
Yeah.
And she was so gorgeous and
no,
attractive.
No, she was
in
never
that
gorgeous.
Film.
She's a phenomenal actress.
Okay, I'm going to try to rescue you, Joyce Cole Hayward, because you're in big trouble.
I need no rescuing.
Matthew Weiner, I assume most people who are Sopranos fans like me and like most of America know he was a writer there, and then he's the creator of Mad Men, two of the great series of all time. I know you interviewed him once. This is for both of you guys, starting with you. Do any of these people who have created brilliance on television, on HBO, on AMC in the last decade, do any of them make the transition to film? Do any of these people do films, or have they decided?
Well, George Clooney is the obvious, you know, I mean, ER.
Okay.
And then he's huge. He's the king of Hollywood now.
But that's almost
but
before
it's a harder...
this most recent era of the Weiners and those sort of people.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can't imagine why. I don't know why Don Draper, i.e. John Hamm, hasn't made that big leap. I mean, he's got it all. He's like, send up a leading man from Central Casting, and there he is. And he's had a couple roles, you know, The Town, and he's done that movie in the role in Bridesmaids.
But I mean the people behind the scenes, the Weiners, the people with the brains who create
the creative talent?
Yeah. I mean, does anybody make the transition, Jared Bowen?
I'm not thinking of anyone either who really makes it. Because I think it's so different. Because obviously, if you're writing for episodic television, you have 24 hours or 12 hours, depending on what your medium is, to stretch out your story and really develop characters and have these arcs and nuances. And of course, you can't do that in a film. So I think they're almost two very, very different disciplines.
Well, you also have a lot more latitude on TV. I mean, right now, and you know, in movies, it's like movie by committee. And if you don't have special effects and car crashes, and you know, a lot of the really potent, interesting drama is now the province of cable television.
Yeah, but I thought that Mad Men was rather a disappointment on
Sunday
night. Oh,
I totally disagree. Jared and I were talking about this.
I finally was able to watch it last night, and I was mesmerized
so
by it beginning to end. And the thing is, it moves so slowly, but then you think, oh my goodness, it's over already, and it was 2 hours, but it's over already, even though every scene is so deliberate, and it's so much about conversation and character development. I was telling Joyce, I can't stop thinking about the scene with Betty Draper lying in bed with her husband and being so violent and suggesting her husband violate the 15-year-old girl who's staying in their house.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, but it gets
so
to
weird.
the dark character that Betty Draper is. And I think, you know, here in 2013, we look back to the 50s or now 60s and think, oh, everything was idyllic and you had these wholesome families. Well, of course not. People are as they were then, as they are today.
But, I mean, look at the cultural backdrop. It was 1968. Things are in turmoil. This episode starts with somebody having a heart attack somewhere and we don't know who it is. So immediately we're plunged into life and death. Cut to Don Draper sitting on a beach in Paradise, Hawaii, reading Dante's Inferno. And the line is, in the midst of the journey of our life, I found myself in a dark wood where the straight way was lost. So he's
good
at a
reading,
crossroads. I mean, he's
okay,
at a crossroads.
Okay, so Joyce, let's ask the critical question
yes.
here, and then we'll move on to the stage. I assume you would agree that January Jones, the thin January Jones, could play Daisy Buchanan.
Absolutely.
But the larger January Jones could not.
Who's
is that correct?
Suddenly gone dark? Yeah,
she
like the
dark
thing.
As she ever.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You know, that's a good question, though. I mean, I've talked to a couple of friends since the Mad Men debuted for the new season, and they were talking about the kind of puffed up January Jones, how upset they are about this.
Yes.
Because, you know, she was Grace Kelly before, and now she's not Grace Kelly anymore, or at least Grace Kelly when Grace Kelly was on the stage of a star of stage and screen. What about that weight gain for January Jones?
This is why I love Mad Men, because it forces you, it challenges you to see these characters, who they really are. You're not going to see these idyllic characters. You're not going to find heroes those. I mean, you have John Hamm, this really good-looking guy. He's in Don Draper. He's really successful, but he's so flawed. The same with January Jones. Beautiful, muse, gorgeous, you know, the two children in the great suburban home, but deeply, deeply flawed. Yeah. And here you're going to physically see it as well. And you can see her look almost uncomfortable with her fat costume.
But also, yeah, these people are on a trip. I mean, I have committed to these characters, and they started out beautiful, and now they're in these midlife crises where things are blowing up. Don's looking a little seedy. Betty's gone dark, and she's blown up. And Don is sitting in this bar in the middle of the night, and he meets a soldier who's just like he was
exactly
when he was in the war, when his identity completely shifted. And there's all this symbolism about dead mothers and about water and rebirth, jumping into the ocean and that baptismal water from the Jordan River that Roger presents his daughter with.
You know what's going to happen? Yeah, Marjorie and I are so impressionable when it comes to art. We couldn't stand it Sunday night. I would say by next Sunday, we're going to love the Bremer episode. Okay, Joyce Kolaywick and Jared Boner with us. Let's move to the stage for a second. Broadway Across America comes to Boston. It's Broadway in Boston. What do we have to look forward to, Jared, first, please?
Well, the most exciting thing is that for the first time in 7 years, we have a pre-Broadway show here in Boston. Of course, Boston was one of the major tryout towns in this country for getting shows to New York. You had Annie Get Your Gun in Oklahoma and Carousel. All of these shows, Porgy and Bess, that tried out here, many at the Colonial Theater right here in Boston. And that sort of went away. You know, economics changed, theater changed. But for the first time, we're going to have one back in 7 years. It's Tuck Everlasting, which is the children's, the very beloved children's story written
yes.
by a woman who lives in Rhode Island.
Natalie Babbitt.
And Joyce recently spoke to her at a presentation of Broadway Across America that I saw. And this looks like a really, really engaging production. They're putting a lot of money into it. And it sounds like a very sweet story. And I think we're seeing something happening here between Billy Elliot and now Matilda that's just on Broadway, the Roald Dahl story that's come over from London. And, you know, this is all about, well, actually, it's a little bit dark in the end about life. And
well, it's about everlasting life and about finding this family that may have found the secret to life. But very exciting for Boston is it's going to be in the Colonial, and we're going to get it before Broadway, and it's terrific. I actually heard some of the music and talked to the creative team. It sounds pretty good, but again, just a preview.
Why is this happening, though? If the economics have changed, why is this show coming to preview in Boston?
Well, I think we have some great advocates. First of all, Joe Spalding, who runs City Center and Wang yeah. Theater, has teamed up with Broadway Across America. And, you know, they, of course, they're a big presence in the Broadway community. And so they know what producers they can attract. And, you know, they very aggressively want to bring these shows here because when they do bring them here, it's an investment in Boston. You know, the shows run longer. It's bigger crews, bigger engineers and everything. And so it is a benefit to the local economy.
Okay.
Can we mention one last movie that's on the horizon? This is 42, the story of the American legend. And obviously there's a piece of this that has a Boston connection. This is the Jackie Robinson story. Harrison Ford, who I love, plays Branch Rickey, who was the head of Major League Baseball. Here's a little piece of it.
You think God likes baseball, Herb?
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
It means someday you're going to meet God. And when he inquires as why you didn't take the field against Robinson in Philadelphia, and you answer that it's because he was a Negro, it may not be a sufficient reply.
I love the movie already. What's the word,
yeah,
Joyce?
That's one of my big picks, 42, and it actually opens this Friday.
Oh, it does?
Yeah, April 12th. Chadwick Boseman plays Jackie Robinson. Harrison Ford, as you mentioned, Brad Tricky, and of course he was the first black player to break the baseball color barrier by signing with the Brooklyn Dodgers. It was written and directed by Brian Helgeland, who did L.A. Confidential, who did Mystic River, did the screenplay for both of those films. So this bodes well. It looks like it's going to be inspiring. It's a story that's going to grab a lot of people. And it's probably one of the first movies in a long drought that anybody's really interested in.
You excited about it?
I am excited. And I just read this Chadwick Boseman has come out of nowhere. This is his first major role. And I just read the sweetest thing that he went to. He waited till this mall closed recently and showed up late at night just to see his big poster on the wall.
That is great.
The security guard
that.
Came
that
over and he said, "That's me up there," because he knew this is probably the last time he can do it before he gets really famous and won't be able to hold on to his anonymity.
What's the best sports movie of all time, Jared Bowen? I know it's a horrible question with no time
Secretariat,
to think.
Secretariat, Jim.
Oh, we know what you think.
Secretariat, and I like that one about the Hoosiers.
Dreams.
Hoop Dreams? No, or no, there's another one.
No,
Friday Night Lights? That's
no,
the TV show.
No, no, no. You know the one I mean.
With Gene Hackman.
Yeah, Gene Hackman's in it. Okay.
What is it called?
I don't know, but
Hoosiers. Thank you very much.
It is Hoosiers.
Okay, so Jared, now you've had 30-second reprieve. What's the best sports
movie? I'm going to be cheesy and just go with Field of Dreams.
Well, that's great. There's nothing wrong.
You can't walk away from that movie without having just being filled with goosebumps.
That was great. Men especially love that movie. Fathers, sons, and baseball.
Quick question. How much in advance do you get to see these movies? For example, the Jackie Robinson movie coming out on Friday. When do you get to see it?
Actually, there's a screening of that this coming week, or there is. It's on
it's
now.
It's usually the week the film comes out, we get to see it.
The week before.
Sometimes it's 2, 3, or 4 weeks in advance, and on occasion it's much farther, but usually it's a week or two.
It can be tough. I'm interviewing Dennis Quaid tomorrow for this movie that he's coming out.
I love him.
I'll bring you with me.
Thank you.
Just like I said, I'll bring you to porn.
I'm ready to go to Pornokio.
Why can't Ryan Landry play Daisy Buchanan? Speaking of...
he probably could.
Has anybody seen his M, by the way, speaking of
No, I'm seeing it on Friday night. By the way, I'm seeing it on Friday night, and I'm doing a talk back with Ryan Landry at the Huntington Theater on Friday night after the show.
You are.
Fantastic.
Ryan Landry, who's a genius, a total genius.
It's presented by the Huntington Theater. It's at the Calderwood Pavilion in the South End.
Next week, you got to talk about this. I'm giving away free tickets to 42 on my website, joyceschoices.com.
Are we disqualified or can we enter?
You need to log in.
We do. Joyceschoices.com.
Okay. Joyce Kohawick is an art and film critic. You can read her reviews. She just mentioned this at joyceschoices.com. It's a great website. She's also president of the Boston Theater Critics Association. Jared Bowen, of course, is WGBH's arts reporter and host of the new weekly art show, Open Studio, on WGBH. Such fun to having you guys in here. Thank you so much for being here.
Can't wait to hear about M, by the way. I am dying to hear
what
that production is like.
Play about child killers.
A musical comedy about child killers. Nothing quite like it. Thanks to all of you guys for listening today to Boston Public Radio. You can find us on the web all the time at wgbhnews.org/BPR. You can also follow us on Twitter at Boss, as in BOS, as in Boston Public Radio, and facebook.com/Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow on Open Mic, Christopher Lydon talks about the wonders of Boston jazz, and Boston's language columnist joins us to describe a special lingo that belongs only to Boston drivers. That's tomorrow on Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
See you tomorrow at noon. Thanks so much for being with us.